There are certain things the English might say in praise of the Welsh. They come from a small but proud nation. They are perhaps the only country that can compete with the New Zealanders for their love of rugby. It's coded into their DNA, played nationwide in the cities, hills and across their famous valleys. They have an uncanny ability to forge swashbuckling marauding powerhouses and twinkle-toed sleight-of-feet speedsters in equal measure. And the fans? Hell, the fans. They're renowned for their stirring hymns, clad in the national emblem of the daffodil, the three feathers emblazoned on their chest. The passion and fight shown by the nation as a whole is what gives them their legendary reputation as fire-breathing dragons. The image captures the imagination, but so does the playing style. This is a nation that doesn't always win, but when it does, it often wins in style. It enjoys remarkable success, usually in purple patches, like during the 1970s and the late 2000s. This is an episode about Wales and the Six Nations, and this is the Sporting Almanac Podcast. So it's our job today to try and make this positive, because Welsh Rugby Union is not very positive at the moment.
Yeah, leave it to two Englishmen to magnanimously lift up the morale of the Welshman and woman at the moment. I think it can be done.
Yeah, I mean, they need it. Let's be honest.
They do need it.
If you're a Welsh Rugby Union fan.
They do need it.
They're very lucky to have not been hit for 50 points in the first two games. England took their foot off the gas. France did not.
I was at the France game and it was brutalizing. 19 clean line breaks in the first half.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, that could have been perhaps even... I would say France left 30 points out there.
Which is crazy. I mean, the whole thing about the Six Nations, the joy of the Six Nations is it's close. Anyone can beat anyone. I mean, Scotland have just shown anyone can beat anyone. England on the back of a massive winning streak and take your foot off the gas for a second and... you lose it.
It's no, I agree. It's a difficult tournament. We discussed that in the first intro episode, didn't we? How variable the winners are.
Yeah.
And how difficult it is in particular to go away. But even in that context, this Welsh team is in dire straits.
But it stands in stark contrast to how Wales have been during our lifetime.
Yeah.
Because usually... they punch well above their weight.
Yeah, that's true. I was going to say, it's not always been this way. Although it also has always, not always, has also been this way for yeah. them. But not always. You're right. They have punched above their weight. And particularly in the last 20 years, they've been quite incredible, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they had a spell between 2005 and 2013, 4 wins in the tournament and 3 Grand Slams in 9 tournaments, which is... I mean, it's as close to dominance as you get in the Six Nations, because this is not a tournament that is ever dominated by a single team, and that is about as close in our lifetime as we've had to dominance. So
yes,
they can be very good.
They were really good. They had like a golden era, perhaps their second ever golden era, the original golden era, which we spoke about a little bit on the Lions tour podcast, because it was just dominated by Welshmen between, and that was their team between 1975 and 1979, where they won 4 times in 5 years with 2 slams and a triple crown. France were the only team who basically broke their dominance. But in that year, Wales still won the triple crown.
Quite a consolation. And they were doing it playing very, very attacking rugby, which is sort of synonymous with how Wales go about the game historically. And again, all of this just emphasises just how much of a change in fortunes they are currently in relative to much of their history.
They play a brand, don't they?
They certainly do, yeah.
And it's a very attractive brand, and I think it's that combined with their rather miniature stature as a nation that captures the hearts and minds. Because, you know, it's hard not to love an underdog, and it's even harder not to love an underdog that plays Champagne Charlie rugby football.
The only other nation you can really compare it to in terms of
the size of the country and how much they adore this sport is New Zealand. It's a country which is quite similar culturally in many ways to it. Obviously, New Zealand are probably better at rugby, you would say, over the years. But
are you talking about sheep, Jack?
I'm not just talking about sheep, Ben. But sheep certainly do play a big part in the culture. But no, I mean, what is it? 3 million people in Wales. Tiny country, very small pool of players to pick from. They do play other sports as well. Obviously, they play football. It's very, very popular in the cities, especially football. But rugby is popular all over, and it's been popular for, well, I'll go back and tell you the history if you'd like.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you know I love it.
You teased me with this offline, and I'll be honest, I actually don't know the origins of Welsh rugby, so it would be nice to learn.
Well, I'll try and keep it as brief as possible, because these are short episodes, but basically, so rugby-like games, similar to in the rest of the United Kingdom, they've existed in Wales for many, many years. A game called Canapan, in parts of West Wales particularly, which was a mass participation inter-village sport similar to sort of other proto-football games. Basically a small wooden ball which had been soaked in animal fat to make it difficult to catch. And the aim was starting from a central point to try and get it back to your church in your particular village. Probably like 1,000 people on each side. Deaths weren't uncommon. You'd have the ordinary folk playing on foot and the gentry joining in on horseback. So yeah, it was cross-class, which is...
horses versus man.
Yeah. Hence the deaths and injuries, I imagine.
Wild.
It's actually quite similar to how rugby is in Wales nowadays, in that it is quite cross-class relative to in England and Scotland, where it does tend to be public schoolboys that tend to dominate the national teams. In Wales, it's rural, it's urban, it's rich, it's poor, it's everyone in between. It's embedded in the culture far more than anywhere else.
That's very interesting, because currently they're... enormous downturn. It's obviously multivariable, multifaceted.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's been cited as being a potential problem for them in recovery is the absence of public schools.
Yeah.
And a public school system, because even Ireland have been exploiting that, hence the reason why they have such a good program out of Dublin. But yeah, that's really interesting that they basically have never been reliant on it.
I wonder whether the upturn in success of their football team as well, association football team, is also having an impact. Basically, it's all Gareth Bale's fault.
And the player pool and only having so many schools and so much interest. And yeah, if you divert that interest, then you see consequences 10 years after the fact.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah. A couple of Euros, a couple of World Cups will do that to you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Euro semi-final in the football.
Who could forget?
Incredible.
Carnu.
Incredible, yeah. So rugby union arrived in Wales in the mid-19th century. The usual routes for Victorian Britain: schools, universities, the armed forces, cross-border contact with English clubs, that kind of thing. It accelerated in growth through growing towns and industrialization, and same routes that we've talked about in the past. People had more time off. They wanted to play sport. This was a popular sport. They started playing it. So they played their first ever international against England on the 19th of February, 1881. They got smashed, but it being smashed caused them to take it a bit more seriously. So they formed the Welsh Rugby Union. The Welsh Football Union, I should say, later the WRU, the Welsh Rugby Union, on the 12th of March, 1881. And that union became a founding member, as Wales, of the International Rugby Football Board, now World Rugby, alongside Scotland and Ireland in the late 1880s. And they started playing the Home Nations Championships, along with the rest of them, in 1883, when it started. And they won their first Triple Crown in 1893, so it very quickly became...
got good at it.
...successful and popular. Yeah, but they got good at it very quickly.
Mm.
But 1895, rugby fans, do you know what happened in 1895? I hope you do, because we've talked about it before. The Great Split in England. So, the Great Split in England, 1895, created Rugby League, essentially, in the north of England. So, the question is, because to me, Wales, culturally, economically, industrially, at the time, was very, very similar to Yorkshire and Lancashire, I would say. So why didn't Wales split off and start playing rugby league instead? They had lots of working class players. Those working class players presumably would like to be paid for their time. So there's a few reasons why it differed in Wales to in the north of England. Firstly, as I mentioned, it was a cross-class sport. It wasn't entirely separate. In England, the south was very, very wealthy. It was built around the public school system. The north was very, very industrial. It was built around working people. There was practical constraints as well. Joining the Northern Union would have meant stepping outside the international framework at the time. There was no international framework in rugby league, and Wales were obviously having success. So even so, like, tensions around money and amateurism existed in Wales, just as in Northern England, and the boundary between amateur and paid could be contested in practice. So one famous example of this was a man named Arthur Gould. So this is called the Gould case in Welsh rugby. It became a major flashpoint. Basically, Arthur Gould was the hero of that 1893 Welsh Triple Crown. He was the captain of the team. He was getting on in years. He was in his mid-30s now, and he was looking to retire. And as is often the case when players are looking to retire, happens a lot in association football, they decide to hold a testimonial for him to raise money for him to sort of allow him to start his life. And they raised enough money that they were able to buy his house off him and then gift it back to him. So basically, he didn't have a mortgage to pay for the rest of his life, which, as you can imagine, is a good way to set up your retirement. However, the RFU intervened and said, this constitutes professionalism, and threatened to sanction the Welsh Rugby Union and ban Gould from all forms of the game in perpetuity. The Welsh obviously bit back against this, and this was just after the 1895 split. They were threatening to break away too. So at the time as well, it was fairly common for Welsh Rugby Union players to be paid. Obviously, it's boot money. It's a little pound note in boots, as you can imagine. It's very much under the table. And the RFU were aware of this as well. And they were just poised to investigate when the split happened, 1895. And it's all a question of timing, because the RFU, if they'd have gone in hard, if they'd investigated, the time was right for the Welsh Rugby Union to break away and join Northern Rugby. And the RFU backed down. And that is essentially the main reason why Wales plays Rugby Union now and not Rugby League, in a nutshell.
That's pretty cool. It's a good story. And for the sake of the successes of the Welsh national team, quite an important series of events, really.
That's how it went.
History is history. The rest is history.
Indeed. And Wales played one of the famous early international matches of rugby in 1905, when New Zealand were touring the country, the famous Originals New Zealand tour. They played a 3-0 win for Wales, and it was dubbed, perhaps prematurely, the match of the century, given that was the name it was called before the game was even played. It ended up being 3-0, and it was in 1905, so probably prematurely.
Yeah, not a classic in the end.
But famously, in response to the New Zealand hacker, the Welsh fans, being Welsh, loving their singing, sang Land of Our Fathers in response to that hacker. And that is believed to be the first time a national anthem has been sung at an international sporting event. And of course, it had to be the Welsh doing it.
That's actually, I didn't even think to look up the origin story of Land of Our Fathers in association with Welsh rugby, because obviously, as a national anthem, it's probably been around longer. What about Bread of Heaven? Got anything on that?
I don't have anything on Bread of Heaven. Why would you put me on the spot like that?
Well, only because you often surprise me with your background knowledge to these things and history, but that was unfair, because that's a very specific hymn, but it is one that's sung regularly.
I think I still remember the words from school, if that matters. I can't sing it quite as well as a Welsh rugby fan can.
Yeah, and it's probably worth mentioning for anyone, because anyone who's Welsh and likes their rugby, we're sort of preaching to the choir, pun intended, but the others, anyone else, Wales fans sing hymns in support of their team.
And they sing hymns very well.
Yeah.
Famously well.
And they have a stadium which has a roof that closes, and when that roof is closed and the population are singing their hymns, it can be really quite something.
It was closed for you at the weekend, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Except everyone hates going, so it was essentially a home game for the French.
Oh, wow.
It was wild. La Marseillaise was probably louder than Land of Our Fathers.
I think that's what you call a low point.
Yeah, it was bad.
It's all up from here.
Wasn't sold out. Yeah, and there were probably just as many French fans as there were Welsh fans. It was maybe not 50-50. It's probably 60-40, but the 40 of the French were in full voice, and the 60 of the Welsh were less so because of recent form.
That's incredible. That's a national crisis, that is.
It is. Welsh rugby is in national crisis, and so shall we tell a story or some stories of times when they were not?
I think we should. Where should we start?
Well, I would like to tell stuff of our era. If you want to talk about the 70s, then feel free.
No. I think keep to our era, because we have an emotional attachment to it, even if those emotions often are disappointment, because England are sometimes on the receiving end of this.
Yeah, well, yeah, quite often, actually.
You get used to it.
We get used to it. Everyone hates us. We understand. Okay, so the background, we were saying Welsh rugby ebbs and flows. So it was flowing in the 70s. And then thereafter, it ebbed, should we say.
Yeah.
Perhaps reaching a low point in the late 90s again. They actually won a championship in 1994, but they had been indifferent since their dominance in the 70s. I think they had only won two tournaments between the 70s. And one of those was shared with France in 1988. Their last Grand Slam was obviously in that period of dominance in the mid-70s or late-70s. So Wales was ebbing, but it would soon be flowing again.
Indeed.
And going into 2005, that was the situation. They had been poor, they were on an upturn, but the trajectory was unclear. Would they reach the heights of those 70s again? Would anybody ever get close to that 70s team? And the answer was maybe not quite as categorical a yes as you might imagine, but it was certainly they would get to the heights that would at least make them worthy of being in the same conversation of that great team.
Indeed. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
You're never going to compete with 4 and 5 years unless you can get close to that. But yeah, but it was a damn good team in 2005.
It was a damn good team. And 2005, okay, so out of the gate, they faced England in round one. It would ultimately prove a pretty memorable occasion because it was essentially the dawn of a new era. England were pretty depleted, to be fair, numerous injuries, key players.
Yeah, excuses in early.
Yeah, I would say that. We would say that. But not many fancied the Welsh anyway. They hadn't beaten England for 12 years, but they finally got the better of them in Cardiff. Trademark finish from Shane Williams. Shane Williams being a legendary, small in stature.
Very small, yeah, I was going to say.
Mighty in heart, pace, power, agility.
Perhaps a relic almost of the past. You're probably not going to find too many people of his stature on the wing in modern rugby union. Very, very fun to watch.
That's actually a very good link back. He very much had the hallmarks of some of those greats in the 70s, like jinking, sidestepping people, just being very evasive and very, very fast.
Yeah.
But yes, it was his try that meant that Wales were leading 8-3 at the break. Charlie Hodgson. We were depleted. I like Charlie Hodgson. He was a good player.
18 months after England were world champions with Johnny Wilkinson at 10, and now we've got Charlie Hodgson at 10. Again, he's a classical fly half, Charlie Hodgson. That's the nicest thing I can say about him. Very catch and kick. Not quite Johnny.
Yeah, and did win a premiership with Sale.
He did, yeah.
Charlie Hodgson was a good player. We're not here to talk about him. he nearly dashed Wales' hopes with 10 minutes to go by putting the visitors in the lead for the first time. Step forward, and you'll remember this.
I will.
Gavin Henson.
Yeah.
He
was a man of the moment, wasn't he? I swear he was only famous for about 2 years.
Yeah.
In the mid-2000s.
Yeah, and he married Charlotte Church.
He did marry Charlotte Church, yeah. Which is about as Welsh super couple as super couple could get.
Yeah. It was weird, the furore around Gavin Henson. But he had an odd kicking style.
He did.
But he had a monster boot. And
he certainly did.
He struck a 45-metre penalty, which obviously sailed through the posts with under 5 minutes to go. And that clinched an 11-9 win over the English. First time, as you say, in 12 years. So, you know, people were buzzing. They were optimistic. And they had cause to be.
Absolutely. Can't blame them.
They were led by coach Mike Ruddock. That's probably worth mentioning. Haven't mentioned that yet. And they put together some pretty, some sublime performances. They beat Italy and Scotland quite comfortably and then edge past France in Paris, which is no mean feat.
I was going to say, yeah, never is.
Yeah. And that set up an Ireland clash in round five and a shot at glory, a day of destiny. It's been referred to. And the Welsh faithful, they were hoping for just one more win to seal a historic championship and a slam. And they got off to a pretty damn good start with Gethin Jenkins showing off his footballing skills. The touchdown.
You love to see it.
Yeah, yeah. Gethin Jenkins being front row, therefore not often lauded for his footballing skills, I imagine.
Well, I think that just the word skill in general is not one you'd associate with the front row in rugby. They are your powerhouses, shall we say. Men of strength and courage. Not men of skill.
Yeah.
But you love to see it.
You do love to see it. And it's
representing.
It's the sort of thing that when it occurs, as a fan out of control with no way of influencing events as they transpire on the field of play, you start to wonder, like, is it going to be our day today? If the prop if the prop's knocking the ball down the line and scoring, yeah. Anyway, it was going to be their day. I think Ireland kept shooting themselves in the foot, a bit of ill discipline, etc. Maybe a bit of imprecision going forward. Yeah, and Wales just rode the wave, and Kevin Morgan extended the lead to 23 points in the second half. And from there, it was really just plain sailing to the finish line. Cue utter jubilation, pandemonium. I mean,
yeah.
Well, Cardiff's not a big city. It's a beautiful city, but it's not a big city. And when the rugby game's on, the Millennium Stadium, the Principality as it is now known, is slap bang in the centre of it.
It's so good. It's 5-10 minute walk from the pubs and stuff down to it. It's I love Cardiff.
Yeah. And what it means though is that it's inescapable when the rugby is on.
Oh yeah.
Because there's people everywhere. It's not like what we're trying to say is it's not one of these stadiums where you have to get a tube or a train out to some suburb in the middle of nowhere where they've bought some cheap land and thrown up a mega stadium. It is a mega stadium in the beating heart of the city. It's like it's almost like a cathedral.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when Wales are doing well, Cardiff's a pretty vibrant place. And yeah, Wales have beaten Ireland at home for the first time since 1983 and claimed their first Grand Slam in 27 years and their first championship since the early 90s. So you can imagine the scene.
I can imagine the scenes. I wish I was there. Although we weren't quite old enough to buy a drink at that point, although might have got away with it.
I really remember that game because I'm pretty sure that was the game, the England game that is, when Matthew Tate got hammered by Gavin Henson. Or it could have been a year or two later. I can't remember. But do you remember?
Maybe.
Tate played for England as an 18-year-old and Henson was playing for Wales in the field. Yeah, I think it was that game, but because I'm pretty sure
feels right.
Yeah, because I think Matthew Tate played for England in that World Cup final in 2007 when he did.
Yeah,
when we got done by South Africa, and nearly scored a wonder try. So the timing feels right, but it could be the 2007 edition at Cardiff. I don't know. It doesn't matter.
He made his England debut in 2005, so I would say probably quite likely. He's only 40 now.
Yeah,
Matthew Tate.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Very young. But Jack, that wasn't the end of this Welsh purple patch, this flow of Welsh rugby, as I keep referring to it.
No, it wasn't.
2008?
Yeah, 2008. A new coach at the helm, a legendary Welsh coach, Warren Gatland, probably the most revered coach in Welsh history, possibly.
Yeah, he really is. Like, I think there's a gate named after him at the stadium now. But yeah, I think the thing that's interesting about 2008, and this is the great thing about the Six Nations, is it just throws up those unique challenges, the way the fixtures lie. For those who are eagle-eyed or eagle-eared, rather, will have noticed that this is 3 years after 2005. So the return fixture against the English is at Twickenham. And
all the fixtures are reversed.
That's a different challenge. England round one, first championship clash with his new look Wales team at Twickenham for Mr. Gatland, looking to end a 20-year hoodoo on English soil. And they didn't get off to the best start, actually. Johnny Wilkinson and Toby Flood. Again, like, I'm being unfair on these fly halves because they're being mentioned in the same breath as the great man.
Yeah, I think this is a problem that every English fly half had probably until Owen Farrell.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
That you were just going to be compared to Johnny Wilkinson and therefore unfavourably.
Yes. And despite his shortcomings, because he was playing next to the great man, England were well in control, 19-6, midway through the second half. But a crumble to end all crumbles. Because, to be fair, it's what, two scores, but away, not long to go, that's pretty difficult. And Wales, well, they did the difficult in spectacular fashion. James Hook got the ball rolling, cut the deficit to 10, and then with a kick at goal, and then with tries coming in from Lee Byrne and Mike Phillips in the space of 6 minutes, they were ahead. And Gatland's tenure, well, it couldn't have started better, really.
No, it couldn't.
Yeah, well, look, momentum is momentum in rugby. You mentioned it at the top of the episode, how you can get on a roll, but it can also be stopped very abruptly. They pumped Scotland, they pumped Italy, they went to Croke Park in Ireland, won 16-12 there, setting up a very tasty final match against France, although at home this time. France going into the game also with a shot at the title.
As is often the case, yeah.
Yeah, so France beat Wales and they could have won the title but not the slam, whereas Wales win and they win the slam. That was the equation. But Wales were at their best, and Wales at their best at that point were rampant. And they just romped. Romped is a good word. To a 29-12 win, delivering their second title and Grand Slam in 4 years. So, yeah, buses, mate.
Yeah, it really is. I was saying earlier, you can't be compared to this 1970s team unless you come close to replicating that. It's very harsh on a team who won, and we're going to get into the third one in a second, three Grand Slams in less than a decade, to say they don't compare, because, I mean, it's still a hell of an achievement. Not four wins in 5 years and a couple of Grand Slams, but still, very impressive.
It's very impressive. I mean, especially because of the size of the nation again, and the teams that they're going up against and the competitiveness. Now, it's right to say, for anyone who's new to rugby and or has taken a recent interest in the Six Nations, that like this isn't the France system that's currently in place that they're up against. But the French were no pushovers. But we'll talk about the French on their own episode, but they've effectively reformed their system and are now just a factory of talent.
I was going to say strength in depth,
yeah,
is unbelievable, as well as supreme talent at the top.
Yeah, and England have always, because as you said, the public school system, been a strong nation. Ireland, again, it's not the Ireland of now that the Welsh team were up against, but they were... You know, they had O'Driscoll and co. It's that era.
And they won Grand Slams of their own in this period.
I was going to say, we'll talk about the Irish, but this is sort of the renaissance of Irish rugby this period. So they were going up against some serious teams who were successful in their own right during this era. But 2012, 2013, that's the best it's ever got for Welsh rugby since the halcyon days of the 70s.
It was unfortunate in a way they fell, as it so often seems to do, certainly for Ireland, smack bang in the middle of a World Cup cycle.
Yeah.
Because they were arguably one of the best teams in the world at this point.
Yeah, they were. And well, in 2011, they made the semis, didn't they? And got arguably screwed by that Warburton red card, which probably wouldn't be a red now. I don't know. Maybe it would now, actually. There was a period of time where you would have been unlucky to be sent off for that challenge, and it definitely cost them. Anyway, 2012, I mean, we've just said it, Wales were incredible by this point. They had made the semi-final of the World Cup. It would have been a first World Cup final for them. That's how good they were. Round one was tricky. They went away to Ireland. The Aviva, the newly built Aviva, edged past them 23-21 with a 75th minute George North try. And George North is one of my favourite players ever.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a Northampton Saints fan, and yeah, he obviously played for Saints for a while as well. A dominant force at his peak. Incredible player.
Yeah, just had an unfortunate history of concussions.
He did, yeah. Once he got one, they just kept coming.
Yeah.
Which is the nature of concussions, really.
Unfortunately, yeah. Yeah, but brilliant winger.
Yeah, very good.
An absolute unit.
Yeah, yeah. He's probably actually one of the few, or one of the original Northern Hemisphere wingers to sort of adopt that combination of being a absolute giant and absolutely rapid. But yeah, sorry, they beat Ireland. Comfortable home win against the Scots. They were dispatched. Round three, away again to England at Twickenham. And they kept England tryless as they very efficiently dispatched us 16-12. Another 75th minute try from Shane Williams. I think I remember this about this Welsh team, that you just couldn't put them away. And they came on strong at the end of games quite frequently. They were quite attritional, like very good when they had the wind in their sails, crowded their back, but also able to just dog it out when needed.
Yeah, find a way to win.
Mm. And yeah, this is the rotation of fixtures where they could dispatch Italy and face France again in round five, again at home, again another title as they surge to a 16-9 win. Third title in 8 years. Basically, they were built on like solid defence, ruthless efficiency, like we were saying. Kept France tryless. That's England and France not crossing the whitewash. Pretty good stuff to be, and winning away in Ireland.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Very impressive.
So that was 2012. And then 2013 was a weird tournament.
It was, yeah.
Very, very weird tournament.
France were awful.
France were awful, yeah. Came last. for the first time since 1999.
Yeah, you love to see it.
It was also the first time that every team managed to win at least 3 points, which is the equivalent of a win and a draw since 1974, which is, you know, a long time. And Wales, they start with a loss here. So the slam dream is over out of the gate, Ireland beating them 30-22.
Yeah, but they pick themselves up, as impressive, I think, as notching a slam. When you're favoured for, have the potential, certainly, to win back-to-back slams, to lose it right out the gate, and then to pick yourselves up. Very impressive.
Yeah, France were uncharacteristically poor, as we've said, and so Wales managed to do them 16-6, back on track, arguably. Be it in Italy and Scotland, that I'm not... Have you noticed I'm not going into the detail of the Italy and Scotland games? Because there's not...
It was a bad time, yeah.
There's not really any point. Those nations shall have their episode where we talk of them in more glowing terms.
Indeed, yeah.
Whilst Wales are winning, there isn't really much to say other than Wales won quite comfortably. And then this, and the reason I wanted to talk about this and lord up the Welsh and talk about our era is because, I don't know about you, mate, but I remember this game very clearly.
I think I've tried to not remember this game.
Yeah, could do one of those like Men in Black tools. Just erase the memory.
Yeah, there's about a handful of sporting events in my life I'd quite like to erase out of my memory, and this is definitely one of them.
Yeah, because I just... So England went to the Principality, and they were in search of their first Grand Slam in a decade. So Wales obviously needed to win by at least 7 points to stop them and claim the title themselves, because obviously Wales lost their first game. So Wales aren't going for the Grand Slam, England are, which means that England go into this game, albeit away, albeit against a very, very good Welsh team, as favourite.
Yeah.
And with our fans full of optimism, which is the reason I remember it so clearly.
Yeah, and it's the kind of situation like you're going for a Grand Slam, all you have to do is keep them to under 7 points, so it's like, you know, aim for the stars, you might end up on the shed roof kind of situation. You're not going to lose them by more than 7 points, are you?
Yeah. Are you?
Or are you?
Yeah. I mean, it had all the hallmarks of a Titanic tussle, but what we got, is utter Welsh dominance. It was a bulldozing. 2 Alex Cuthbert tries, 4 half penny penalties, 8 points from Dan Biggar. Just Grand Slam hopes in tatters, mate. Wales 30, England 3. 3.
Oh, God.
Jesus. The victory secured their first back-to-back title since the 70s, hence why we say they are worthy of a mention in the same utterance as that golden team. First time since 1978 and 1979 specifically. Shell-shocked England went home with their tail between their legs, and I can only imagine what Cardiff was like that evening.
Englishmen, Englishwomen quickly departed the city. I think that would be wise.
Get on the train, get across the bridge, just pretend it never happened. But that is those are the stories of a better time for Wales, Jack. They did win another Grand Slam in 2019, and they won the title as recently as 2021.
Yeah, which is crazy.
But
all things considered,
God, the tail off has been insane. Obviously, retirements, you have to replace like talent with talent. And
yeah,
well, that's what Wales have struggled with. And we've already sort of flirted with some of the reasons. Major governance issues, domestic game problems, politics.
Always.
Everything that just influences sport in a way that you'd rather it didn't has sort of combined simultaneously. I mean, they sacked Gatland at the time, sort of as if it was his fault.
Yeah, which is incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's mad. What that's all culminated in, and I don't want to end on a bad note, but the reality is Wales just aren't very good anymore. They received the wooden spoon for the first time in 21 years.
Yeah.
In 2024, which just shows how good they've been.
Well on track to retaining it as well.
Yeah, well, they did retain it in 2025, didn't they?
Oh, right. So, well on track for 3 in a row, I should say.
A hat trick. But yeah, so, you know, I don't know. Is there hope for Wales? Thomas Williams is some player. I'll give you that.
Yeah, yeah. We've got Louis Rees-Zammit back from his NFL adventures as well.
True.
That should be cause for optimism. But, I mean, okay, they're playing England and France in their first 2 games. That is harsh.
The 2 hardest games, probably.
Yeah.
Now that Ireland are just slightly going over the brow of the hill, maybe. I may have spoken too soon because we're recording this before England Ireland.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I guess, what does good look like? Good looks like beating Italy and coming fifth.
Yeah, but Italy have already beaten Scotland.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, you're right.
And then Scotland beat England. So confusing tournament already, other than the fact France are definitely going to win a Grand Slam.
Yeah. No, that's true. No, they've got some good players. They have got some good players. There is cause for optimism, but they really do need to, they need a greater strength and depth of player. Because, you know, we've mentioned Thomas Williams and Lewis Rees-Sammer. They've also got Jack Morgan of Lions fame with the clear out. Yeah, they've still got Josh Adams, but they've got quite a lot of sort of young guys coming through. And it's just, they just don't have any giants like Alan Wynne-Jones, Jonathan Davies. Yeah.
Yeah.
The greats, mate, of that era. Shane Williams, Halfpenny, we've spoken about him. Dan Bigger, Faletau. We haven't even mentioned Faletau by name. Like, they just need to get back to that level. And like, yeah, okay, easy to say, harder to do. But they can do it because they've done it before.
Yeah.
Albeit with a 30-year break in between. Hopefully it's not that long.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think sport is very different. I think the sport of rugby and sport generally is very different now to how it was 20 years ago. I think France are really gapping. I mean, every home nation, in terms of their league system, in terms of their structure, in terms of how they're going about doing the game and bringing players through. I think it's a bigger bridge to gap than it ever has been before, I would say.
I can't disagree with you. What Ireland have done, what England have always had at their disposal, and particularly what France have done, plus a very strong Scottish team at the moment.
Yeah.
Albeit very hot and cold. When they're hot, they're hot.
Against England, basically.
Oh, I mean, yeah. We'll come on to Scotland. Funny old nation. But that's four teams out of six that, you know, are always going to be very, very strong. It's going to take a Herculean effort to get Wales back to the top, I think. But it's been done before.
It has. And I wouldn't rule it out. As I say, it is in the core of the nation. It is in everyone's hearts. They can't be this bad forever.
Or can they? I'm going to Wales Scotland at the weekend, and we'll know more.
Yeah. I mean, they're not going to be happy with the scales of their defeats against England and France, but they were always expected to lose those games. You never know, they might come out with a couple of wins, who knows. I don't think so though.
Yeah, so should we leave Wales there?
I think so.
Next stop, the Azzurri.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, our fifth place finishers of last year, so Italy next.
Cool. Well, see you then.
See you then, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for joining us for our Six Nations series today. We hope you enjoyed what you heard. If you did and want to help out, a like, subscribe, comment or share would be amazing. But above all, tell a friend and spread the word. Thank you very much. Our theme tune is Oh Yeah by Harmony Productions. You can find us on Insta and Blue Sky at The Sporting Almanac. If you've got any ideas for future episodes or any good stories, drop us an email at sportingalmanacpodcast@gmail.com. We'll see you for the next episode. We hope you enjoy the Six Nations until then. And don't forget, sport is nothing without the history that makes it. Goodbye.